I'll go to my next guest who knows far more than me, far better than me. I learn from her every time I watch. I love talking to her. I love her as a person. She's absolutely marvelous in everything that she does. She also happens to be a magnificent host with her own show on CNN every weeknight at 11 p.m. Please welcome back to the show the one and only Laura Coates is with me right now. Laura, good evening. How are you? How's everything?
Oh, I'm doing great. I'm always so glad to be with you. You know how much I love you. So thank you for having me back.
I appreciate that. Let's go to the bigger issue. I had to talk to you about all of these Supreme Court rulings that came down over the last 24 hours or so. First order of business, the Supreme Court had one defining theme. What was it? Mm-hmm. If the Supreme Court had one defining theme in all of this, what was it in your eyes?
The theme really is the separation of powers means something in the sense that he can't infringe on the other branches, power of the purse for Congress, for example. But when it comes to the executive branch, he has expansive powers. He already had expansive powers when it came to immigration and controlling the borders, but now he has expansive powers in terms of being able to fire independent agency heads. He has expansive power in the world, of course, of we're thinking about commerce and what's going on in the sense of, you know, how that's going to be regulated. But he does have the dings, I'll call them. Mm-hmm. The Supreme Court did not allow him to say no to mail-in ballots. They did not allow the President of the United States to say that that the Fed could be controlled by him, that the firings could occur in that realm. And that was a really, really big moment. Basically speaking, the executive branch is powerful. The question, will it be more powerful than the other branches? That's Congress's job to figure out how much they want to allow that to take place.
Reading the opinions, not just the headlines, are you of the mindset? What are you of the mindset, rather, that Americans are misunderstanding about yesterday's rulings more so than anything else?
Now, one of the things that has always sort of stopped me in my tracks is trying to explain it to people is, of course, the Supreme Court has power. We have allowed it to have a great deal of power. We have said precedent means something, that the buck stops there to the Supreme Judicial Nine, and that they have the final word. However, we have seen time and time again over the last 12 years alone that notion of the Constitution and the separation of powers and the buck stopping in various places is more of a gentleman's agreement, right? The idea that the Supreme Court has a final say is only as good as if Congress says, okay, we will leave it there. Mm-hmm. But they don't have to, nor does the President of the United States. I think people fundamentally misunderstand that just because the Supreme Court says something, and we traditionally have viewed what they have said as the final word, their decision to, in many ways, overturn their prior precedent has undermined the longevity of their own finality. And it has also made people wonder just how far they could push the contours of the Constitution, how far they could push the gentleman's agreement, so to speak, and challenge one another's branches in a way that they are trying to, kind of like crabs in a bucket, climb over one another.
How silly am I when I bring up this obvious notion to me? You know, we talk about amendments to the Constitution. Last time I checked, if there's an amendment, that means something was a certain way and you decided that it needed to be altered. So you went and you altered it. There has been alterations to the Constitution. I'm always shocked while everybody leans on the Constitution in such a way as if it's so finite that it can't be changed. It can't be altered. It can't be influenced. Isn't this a reminder that indeed that is just not true, that anything written down, no matter how finite it may appear to be, can be altered, it can be amended, even in this day and age?
Sometimes for the good and sometimes for the bad. Right. Absolutely, it can be. But it is intended to be a difficult proposition to amend the Constitution. It's not intended to be something like a quick law or an executive order, for example, that just says, here's what we're going to do from now on for the duration of my term. It's supposed to be something that is difficult to maneuver. It's going to have the ratification requirements, going to have the buy-in from various states. They knew would have to have those hurdles in place as well. So it's not intended to be a quick change, but there was always the notion that this would be a perhaps living document. Now, originalists, as they say on the Constitution, originalists, the Supreme Court, seem to forget that sometimes. They say, well, only if it's included in the actual text of the Constitution will we honor it in some meaningful way. But they fail to remember sometimes that the amendments and the process of being able to do so does require you to view it more as a living document. And that's a powerful reminder, Stephen A., that things can change, and they can change for the better or they can change for the worse. Some of the Supreme Court decisions recently have said, the birthright citizenship case has said, look, this is what it said. Here's what it intended. They have given a bit of a roadmap, however, for another branch to challenge it. And you already see that happening in the form of the call for U.S. attorneys to prioritize birth tourism, as they call it, which, by the way, is already something that is investigated and is illegal. And it's not necessary to change the 14th Amendment to make that something you could prosecute. But here we are.
You heard the sound coming into the interview where I aired the deputy chief of staff of the White House, Mr. Stephen Miller, talking about essentially how pregnant women shouldn't be allowed to come into the country. Mm-hmm. You know, you might want to keep them away, until they give birth. What were your thoughts about that when you heard that coming from him?
Well, practically speaking, how would you do that? Are you testing people at the border who otherwise have a lawful reason to seek asylum or entry into the country, and you will use and treat them as a subclass if they in fact are pregnant, and therefore you will not allow them in the country? That would have an absurd result. I mean, the idea that somebody would target the United States simply to give birth is part of the culture war, part of the policy debate discussions, part of the hyperbole people often talk about, as if it's a very prevalent and pervasive thing mm-hmm. that's happening. And I'm not saying it does not happen, but if you're going to really practically look at how you're going to evaluate border control, the executive branch absolutely has a right to control migration. They have a right to control borders. They have a right to control exit and entry into this country. But to essentially require somebody who is saying, I have a lawful reason to seek asylum or entrance into this country, and to restrict them on the basis of them carrying a child because you believe that they are only doing it because they want to have the so-called stereotypical anchor baby that people talk about, well, that would not be practical, nor would it be right or just. And mm-hmm. it would be putting people in a different class that others would not. And we do still have equal protection.
Well,
and we are supposed to apply the way we apply the border control policies equally without regard with something like that, instead about whether they qualify for asylum.
Well, Laura, that's the eloquent and brilliant way to put it. No doubt about it. I'm going to be more simplified than that because I'm not as eloquent as you are. Let me be very clear. What the hell are you going to do? Test every woman, give them a pregnancy test, anybody that comes in, right, that crossing the border? Because let me tell you something right now, as a dad, there's a little while before you can tell somebody's pregnant now.
Right.
How you gonna know? It's really that simple to me. I'm like, what? I'm like, how's he gonna pull this off? I'm like, I'm just wondering right here. We're talking to Laura Coates with CNN right here, a Straight Shooter with yours truly. The transgender ruling.
Yeah.
Barring mm-hmm. transgenders from participating in women's and girls' sports. Laura, I have to confess, you have no problem with this decision. I never felt, mm-hmm. I've never been of the mindset that it's been fair to young ladies to have to compete with somebody transitioning, period. That's been my position about this. What did you think mm-hmm. about this ruling?
I was not surprised at all that they had decided this. Remember, this has been a series of different cases. They've already supported the president being able to ban transgender from the military, about having a requirement to have one's assigned sex at birth on an identification. There's been other ways they've talked about these issues as well. In the sports context in particular, at the oral arguments, they were very clear that this was a field, so to speak, unto itself. The idea of trying to figure out how they were going to make exceptions to rules of 27 or 29 different states and not have a patchwork was never practical. But here's the reason why they did it. They didn't go into the policy debates of whether it's the not in my backyard or not on my daughter's playing field conversations. A part of it was about the unfair advantage. But the other part about it was how they were going to treat one's gender identity. Were they going to look at it as, say, race or sexual orientation or religion? How were they going to evaluate the burden, the balancing interests of the state in regulating something and an individual's private interests in not having their rights infringed. And how they decide to do this is so-called intermediate scrutiny, mm-hmm. which essentially says, look, I have to figure out, is there a real relationship between why the state is acting and what they are acting on? Is there an interest that the state has that's going to override a private interest? And in this particular field, they said, yes, you do not want to have the unfair advantage. It's different in the sports world than it would be, say, in a workplace right. or other arena. But also because the NCAA, as you know, already decides on a case by case for sports, for teams, and there's already written into the cake in Title IX and everything else. It says you can have separate. You can have separate girls teams, separate boys teams. Everything need not be totally equal. And in doing that, they already opened the door to having equivalence, not pure equality. And that's why this particular court said, look, in the field of sports where you've got height, weight, you've got athleticism, you've got strength, all these different factors that give an unfair advantage. We don't want an individual entity on a case-by-case basis to have to decide whether they in fact are violating someone's rights. So I'm not surprised by the decision. And frankly, what is really interesting to me, Stephen A., is given the relatively minuscule population of people
right.
who are transgender in sports, it is fascinating to know how many people almost universally have a position and a opinion without actually having the immediate firsthand observation or experience. And that's part of what the Supreme Court was looking at and saying, given the fact that it's such a small population, we're not going to apply the most exacting standard because the impact is not going to be as great.
Laura Coates, Riley Gaines, I'm sure you know that name. She mm-hmm. was the swimmer that competed against Leah yes. Thomas in 2022, tied for fifth place, ultimately mm-hmm. sued to bring this issue to the forefront because her name and her fingerprints are written all over this. I spoke to her earlier today. I want you to listen to what she had to say about what's next because she says she's not finished. Listen to this. You talked about how there's more work to be done, considering the fact that the Supreme Court came down with this ruling. It's now a federal ban. What is the work? What is the additional work you believe there is to be done?
So basically this ruling, it means that it's not illegal for women to have sports exclusive to just women. It's not that, you know, states must have women's only sports. It's that they can. And so 27 states have passed some sort of fairness in women's sports law. My home state of Tennessee has, you know, the ones, right?
Yes.
Texas, Florida, the usual actors in this situation. That means 23 states have not passed some sort of law. California, Washington, Oregon, Michigan, Maine, Minnesota, yada, yada, yada. You get it. We have no reason to believe that they will now follow federal law, that federal law being Title IX. We have no reason to believe that they will follow President Trump's executive orders because up until this point, they think they're giving a middle finger to President Trump. That's really not what they're doing at all. They're giving a middle finger to the little girls in their state who want to compete fairly. So as it stands now, based on this ruling, fairness and safety in women's sports is dependent on your zip code and your geography and where you live. I don't think it should be that way. I think every girl is entitled to equal opportunity, to privacy, and to safety. So still work to be done in those 23 states that have not yet passed state law. So I hope we see real enforcement mechanisms from the Department of Justice, from the Department of Education. I hope we see individual lawsuits and litigation. I hope we see ballot measures. There's a lot of work to do to again, ensure that every girl, regardless of where you live, is protected.
Laura Coates, your response to that?
Well, this goes back to exactly our earlier point in the finality of a Supreme Court decision. They can weigh in on the question that they're being asked. Can these states continue to hold these bans against people who've been assigned male at birth who want to participate in girls' sports at the high school and collegiate level? They're not being asked, hey, do you think that transgender athletes should ever compete? That's not what they're being asked. Sometimes Supreme Court justices will expand on their opinion and give very wide-ranging decisions. But here they were far more nuanced and precise on the question that was presented to them. She's right. There is going to be more to this discussion, primarily when one state that has a ban intends to compete in another state or bring their team to another state where the ban is not in effect and will have to compete against people who do not have the same requirements. That will force the issues of how the collegiate level more broadly addresses it. I do think this has opened a door, though, Stephen A., because we know the Olympics has already wrestled with this issue. Mm-hmm. We know that 27 states have wrestled with this issue. We know that there might be other states who are not just, as she said, trying to give a middle finger to a president, but might have been waiting to figure out if they were going to be bogged down in litigation over an issue the Supreme Court was currently grappling with. They don't want to have their Title IX funding removed. They don't want to have it impeded, but they also don't want to have lawsuits and exposure to those vulnerabilities if they believe that there is a risk that they could be violating a constitutional right. And so there's a lot of things at play here that I think this is going to open the door on. But at the end of the day, individual states, and that's part of our system here in America, although it's a United States without a federal ban or a federal superiority issue here, a supremacy clause issue, the issue is state by state. And we have other areas of our legal system that are part of a patchwork. Some of our gun laws, for example, how people use different voter IDs and licenses mm-hmm. or type identification. Marijuana laws, for example. Supreme Court justices, including people like Clarence Thomas, have been pretty outspoken trying to make sure there has not been a patchwork with respect to drug laws and has failed in the endeavor even to implicitly solicit right. different cases to come before them. So if people have a problem with the absence of true uniformity, I do have some news for you. The way our system is set up as the United States of America, not just one nation, is that there is supposed to be room for that distinction and flexibility. But in areas like this, where you're going to have interconnectivity mm-hmm. and interactions, this will be the next frontier.
Last question in your regards to mail-in ballot. 5-4 decision. Mm-hmm. The Supreme Court ruled that states can count mail-in ballots that are postmarked by election day but arrive later. Your thoughts about that real quick?
Well, we do it for the military. We know there are, we don't all have the ultimate confidence in the Postal Service. I mean, the mail does not always get delivered on time.
No doubt about that.
Shout out to all of you out there, hardworking, but yes. We know all of the different jokes around it have some truth to it. The idea, if it were something that were just at any time after and you could miss election day, I would have a problem with that. I would say you've got to have an election day deadline in terms of when you cast your ballot.
Right.
But when it's counted, if it's dependent on an exterior force or entity, then you cannot undermine the right to vote as a result of it, or right to your vote to be counted. But I do think cases like California, for example, cases where in states where they have a long window of time before we know who in fact will represent somebody in an election, this gives the fodder for people to say, let's change this and get everything counted at once. Mail-in ballots are not inherently going to create fraud. In many respects, allowing people the ability to use alternative means of casting their ballot that they've done so successfully in many states across this country, including the President of the United States, having done mailed ballots in the past, sometimes it opens up the entire electoral franchise more. But I do agree that there has got to be some boundaries on making sure that there is a reasonable time from which ballots are counted, because the seeds have been planted, Stephen A.
Yeah.
And of course, people have a right to know when they voted, what was the result?
That's right.
And I think the more people have to wait, I wonder if they become more apathetic yeah. about the process of voting.
And therefore, they'll delay it even more, procrastinate, or yep. ultimately won't do it. So we don't need that problem, yep. no question about it. Mm-mm. Lauren Coates, appreciate you. Looking forward to being on with you tonight. I'm returning the favor. You're here with me now.
Oh,
I'll be
lovely.
On with you on CNN tonight. I'm looking forward to that. And oh, by the way, I got to thank you in advance for looking out for me. I'm going on vacation after tonight. You're going to be hosting for me next week. You're going to be sitting right
yes.
in this chair, hosting Straight Shooter with yours truly. I only ask one favor. Don't be too damn good. Ooh. Don't take my job. I need my job.
It's an honor. I'll keep the seat warm because your shoes can never be filled. I'll see you tonight.
We're going to stick to that lie. Thank you so much. Take it easy. The one and only Lauren Coates for CNN, the marvelous Lauren Coates for CNN right here with Straight Shooter with yours truly. 866-967-6887 is the number to call up. It's 866-96-POTUS. You're listening live. Stephen A., Straight Shooter in the house. Coming back with your calls and more in a minute.